This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So when I was in school, this would always happen, and maybe you too, I don't know. The teacher would be in the front of the room explaining something important, and I'd be reading a book or looking out the window daydreaming, and suddenly I'd hear my name, and the teacher would order me to pay attention. And I'd insist I was paying attention, and then she'd put me to the test and ask me a question, and I'd answer it, which always resulted in something like, "Good, now pay attention." And eventually, I learned to let it go at that. But it does make you wonder, what is attention? How does it work? How are we able to answer the question even though we were looking out the window? What is it? Well, that's the question we want to examine today. And we want to do it from a couple of different perspectives. Kathy Davidson's a professor of interdisciplinary studies and English at Duke University. She's written a book called Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley is the director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke Integrative Medicine. And you're both here today. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Kathy, how would you define attention?
Attention is basically the way we operate through the world. It is whatever we happen to be focusing on at the moment. But the trick about attention is we're not very attentive to our own attention. So often we think we're paying attention, or we think we're seeing everything around us, but we're also always seeing a very tiny portion and selecting out that portion of the world to see, which means we're missing everything else.
Well, what about my sad grief in school when I said I was not focused on what the teacher was saying and yet able to answer the question?
Well, first of all, we know that one form of attention is memory, and it may be that some of those times that you remember you answered the question, she really knew you were a smart kid and was also helping you along with some hints. Because we know it's hard to pay attention to two things at once. On the other hand, there's something Linda Stone calls continuous partial attention, where you kind of bead in and out of attention. So you might be looking outside the window, but you're also partly listening, and you're doing both at the same time, and getting enough of the story to be able to succeed also makes you very vulnerable, though. If something big happens or surprising happens, you might not be paying attention in any direction.
There were times when I didn't answer. It's quite true. But most of the
that
time,
for all of us.
I got it right most of the time. Jeff Brantley, you are a teacher in mindfulness practice and attention. How do you define attention?
Well, you know, attention in meditation world, as I understand it, is a skill. Mindfulness is the quality we all have of noticing, of non-judgmental awareness, really, of what's here in the present moment. And people like to talk about attention as a skill one can develop. And on a spectrum, there can be selective or focused attention can be cultivated. And then on the other end of that spectrum is unfocused or choiceless awareness, where our field of attention is really so broad that anything that comes to us is something we can notice. But the key in the meditation practice, I think, is that we don't stick to what we're noticing. We don't get or we don't get hijacked away into something else. We just let it come and go. And this is part of how we cultivate the skill of attention. Selective focus or just a wide noticing and releasing, really, of whatever's noticed.
So to cultivate a skill suggests that to some extent there's an essential quality. There is something there to begin with, whether or not we ever cultivate or develop.
Yes, yes. And you know, in my limited understanding of modern neuroscience suggests this is true, that areas of the brain change depending on how we use them. And certainly in studies around meditation that I've seen, brain wave patterns change. Even the structure of the brain in certain areas can shift depending on how one uses one's mind to direct attention, to focus or not.
And so, Jeff is talking about non-judgmental attention. It comes and it goes, so we don't attach ourselves to it. How big a role in your study does judgment play in attention? It's at some point you have to decide what's important and what's not. So that's a judgment. But then the next question is, well, how did that make me feel?
Well, one of the things I was looking at was technology, because so many of us say, oh, we can't pay attention anymore. We have so many things going on at once that we're always multitasking and we're always diffusing our attention, and therefore we're shallow, we're dull. There's no way we can pay attention anymore. And all that really means is our habits of attention are being disrupted. I personally think, and this is where actually I've taken some mindfulness courses where I'm very close to Jeff's idea. I actually think disruption is not a bad thing. That often what that disruption does is makes us aware of habits that in everyday life we just assume are natural, but in fact are invisible to us because they are habits. That's basically what a habit is. You do it so automatically you're not thinking about it. And so part of what mindfulness does is makes us, as one psychologist says, reflective about our reflexes.
So Jeff, you notice when your attention drifted. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In fact, in that popular book by the fellow from Google, Search Inside Yourself, Dr. Tan, he talks about the phrase, and I don't know how many other people use it, but it's an interesting meta-attention, the attention to the attention, you know, which, is, again, is something that's very much of a skill. That, you know, we have the awareness, the mindfulness, but we can have the skill of noticing. We pick a focus in meditation training anyway, and we notice when the attention has shifted off of that focus. And then we train ourselves for training selective attention to come back. And at a certain point, we explore what it's like not even to choose the focus. That'd be the choiceless awareness. And just watch the ever-changing kaleidoscope of experience flowing through this moment.
But Kathy, how does that connect with your idea that this assault on multitasking is, in a sense, misdirected, that we can do two or three things at once? It strikes me that maybe in this conversation, maybe that is the last thing we should be doing.
Well, just as being humans, we automatically do two or three things at once. I mean, if I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm also aware visually of what's going on around me. I'm hearing and screening out noises around me. I'm constantly, the brain is a multitasker. My brain is always multitasking. At the same time, the fact that I'm paying attention to our conversation means there's things I'm missing, right? There's things I'm not seeing at all. So again, I think the point about training attention is learning not how to monotask, because that's impossible, but how to figure out what's important and try to concentrate on that and train attention to that one thing that gets you to the goal that you're after. Being aware that most accidents happen within 5 miles of home, because right when we think we're paying the most attention is probably when we're paying the least attention. And that's a very basic Buddhist idea, too, called katsu, which is this moment where you're when you're meditating and you think you've got it, you think you're there, your Buddhist teacher hits you on the shoulder with a switch to warn you that that's the moment when you're most vulnerable. That moment when you're feeling arrogant about being attentive is when you're probably falling into some bad habits and not paying attention at all.
On the State of Things today, Kathy Davidson, professor of interdisciplinary studies in English at Duke. She's got a book called Now You See It, The Brain Science of Attention, and it will transform the way we live, work, and learn. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke Integrative Medicine. We're talking about attention today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about attention today. Kathy Davidson, professor of interdisciplinary studies and English at Duke. Jeffrey Brantley, director of mindfulness-based stress reduction program at Duke Integrative Medicine. And before the break, we were talking about the relative merits of multitasking. Kathy Davidson says, of course, we're doing that all the time. The brain's got a lot of things going on. I mean, at the very least, you have an autonomic nervous system that's paying attention to your heart rate and everything else that, thank goodness, we don't have to think about. So, but Jeffrey Brantley, when is mindfulness, if we learn to focus and watch our attention and watch it shift, are we learning to focus better on a particular thing, or can we become, in a sense, better multitaskers?
Well, you know, I guess I'm not sure what the definition of multitasking is, but I'm kind of lean with Kathy here. My understanding is we cannot focus on more than one thing at a time. Now, it might happen in time that's events close together or not, but we really are conscious of one thing at a time. Now, also, in the training of attention, I think certainly in the meditative, but there's neuroscience underpinnings to this. Richie Davidson's book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain, is a good source for this. He points out that we can, if we ask you to, if you're in a restaurant and you're listening to somebody and it gets really noisy somewhere else, the prefrontal cortex and other parts of the brain actually help focus the attention on your partner if you're listening to them talk. But they also send signals to inhibit or downregulate the channels that are sending in the information from that's coming in from the other parts of the restaurant. Pretty much what Kathy was speaking about earlier, about information's coming in all the time to our working memory or whatever part of the brain it's in. And there's a choice process going on depending on, in a way, our intention or how we're choosing to focus things. And interestingly enough, studies of meditators have shown that if you train somebody to pay attention to the sensations in their hand or in their body and they choose their hand, that a part of their brain, it's called phase locking. The part of the brain that's picking up the data from the foot or the other parts of the body actually goes into kind of an idling state. And the part that's focused on the hand actually gets a little more active. But this is a kind of a training phenomenon when you look at the brainwave activities of people trained in meditation.
So, Kathy, that's what you talked about earlier, too. There are these structural changes that take place if you become conscious of what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. There's structural changes and behavioral changes. One of my friends, Howard Rheingold, who's a theorist of new media, loves to start his classes by saying, close your laptops, close your cell phones, now close your eyes. And he makes people sit there with their eyes closed for 5 minutes, and then he has them open their eyes and try to tell what happened in that 5 minutes. They can't do it. 5 minutes seems like it would be easy. It's an infinity of trying to chart your own brains. And he makes the point that, yes, the world is bombarding us with lots of information. So in the most quiet, undisrupted place, our own brains, we're very disrupted.
Well, that's when
you ever had insomnia, you know that too.
That's when it gets really noisy, I was going to say. When nothing else is going on, it's only me talking to me. So here we're talking about attention and the way we navigate the world, which of course is very important to all of us. But there, you know, have you ever placed your attention? Is it interesting to other people as well, where you place your attention? And that question might be no more important to anyone than a magician or a pickpocket. Josh Lozov is just such a magician. He is renowned for his strolling and close-up table magic, and as well as stage shows that are absolutely dazzling. And whatever you thought about your powers of attention will be utterly overturned when Josh is in the room, and he joins us now to take a little different perspective on our conversation on attention. Josh, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here. I'm learning a lot about why the things that I do work, so I've been taking notes so far.
We must have thought about that. I mean, the fact is your whole business depends on diverting our attention, right?
Yeah, a significant part of it, certainly. At least learning about how to focus on attention. And the thing that I thought was most interesting is when Kathy used the term about being when people are arrogant about their own paying attention is when they're the most vulnerable, because the best time to create misdirection, which is the term that magicians use for guiding people's attention, is when people really are sure that they're paying attention to everything, you know. So that's the best time, is when they feel like they're in charge of what they're paying attention to, and they're paying attention to the right thing is exactly the vibe that we need to create to get away with something.
That's the importance of all the patter. Look, I'll show you this. Look at this. You see, it's a deck of cards. And that's all part of it. But also what she said struck me, too, as important to the magician. So the Buddhist master has to notice something in, I think, a seated and pretty quiet student. There's not much in the way of behavior. And that teacher noticed you've become arrogant. That must be what you
are. The more focused we feel like we are, again, that's kind of what Kathy was saying. If everything's distracted and crazy and things are going on all over the place, and then something magical happens, a card changes to a different card, people are going to think, well, I just missed it because look at all this distraction. When everything's totally focused and they think that there's nothing to distract them and they're entirely attentive to what you're doing, and then you create that. There's nowhere they can't remember that there was ever a moment that their attention went anywhere else.
Notice that in them? Do you have to see that's the moment?
Yeah, I mean, some of it's like timed. Like here's the moment that I'm always going to create. But a lot of the time, especially with the close-up magic, that's what I love so much about the close-up magic, is it's really on the fly and it's really improvisational. Like I just kind of get a sense. I get more of a sense the more I do it. Like when the right moment is, and when there's 10 people, how to create that? What's the split second that it's the best for everybody to try to get away with the sneaky thing? And when I say get away, I mean one of the things I was thinking of since you invited me on the show was like the difference between, and again, if I distract someone's gaze, if I make them look away, that's what a lot of people think when they think of misdirection. Like you make me look at your right hand while you do something in your left hand. And but, you know, it's too easy for them to go back and say, oh, I was looking at your right hand. That's when you did something with your left. So what's the best is when they feel like, no, I was looking at the left hand the whole time. I didn't take my attention off of it. Because then there's nowhere to go to reconstruct what may have just happened.
Right. That's when you get the it's amazing.
Yeah, then that's when you get it's impossible, which is the goal. The goal is for people to feel like it's impossible because it didn't involve me being distracted because I know I wasn't distracted.
Jeff, you've worked with people especially in the beginning of meditation, and you get them to just sort of focus on their breathing for 5 minutes. And I think you notice that's pretty hard for them to do.
Yes, it is. The attention is trainable, as our other two, my colleagues here, have been talking about. But what we don't realize is we're training our attention in relatively shorter or longer attention spans. And so it moves, you know. And when you ask somebody to put their attention, like when they shut their laptop, shut their cell phone, close their eyes, to notice what's happening, you know, is the mind is probably going all over the place. But I want to come back to something Josh said. There's a concept I find intriguing and really probably have a poor understanding of called attentional blink. And there's a well-known video that was shown where they have a bunch of people passing a basketball back and forth. And the instruction is count the number of passes that the team in white makes, say. And so if you really lock in and say, I've seen every, you know, it's a challenge. What happens, somebody in a gorilla suit walks out there and dances around and then walks off. And then afterwards they ask how many people saw the gorilla. And I have to confess I didn't. And the audience I was in, most of us didn't see it the first time. And the attentional blink, as I understand it, is when the attention is so locked onto, when you think you're knowing what you're watching and you're locked on, that events that happen a few seconds or some short period of time around that, you don't even see it. The attention blinks.
I was waiting for someone to bring up that invisible gorilla test because it's one of my favorites, and it's a great illustration of magic principles because you give the people a task, and that when they feel like they're focused on something, if you just said watch this whole thing, then people don't miss the gorilla. If you say, here's what I need you to do, count the number of basketball passes. So that's what I'm doing all the time, is like, this is a really important thing for you guys to focus on.
Right.
And then people have a task and they have a place to put their attention, and we can put our attention on one thing at a time, and that's when something else can happen.
And Kathy, you talk about that in your book, that particular experiment. And I'll have you talk more about it, but I do have a question at the moment about whether the thing itself, the thing you missed, we missed it because it was so out of the realm of what I was trying to do. In other words, if it had been another basketball, maybe you'd have seen it, but I'm really not expecting a gorilla.
Right. I think it's partly about expectation. It's also partly that the human brain focuses by unfocusing everything else. So we really don't see the gorilla. So I actually did see the gorilla the first time I watched it because I was putting on two reasons. I was putting on an event, and the gorilla experiment was being shown in my event, and I was worried about the waiters and had the president come and all of these other kinds of things. So I looked up, and if it's weird to miss the gorilla, it's even weirder to be in a room with all these super smart people at your university who are not seeing the gorilla and you're seeing it. I mean, I'm like, whoa, I felt like a madwoman. And that's actually a good lesson. I bet our magician friend has something to say about that, because if somebody in the room says there's a gorilla, don't just say they're crazy.
Yeah.
They may be seeing the most important thing you're missing, and that gorilla might get you if you don't see it. So it's I think actually as a method, working with other people who are paying attention in different ways. I'm also dyslexic, so I saw that experiment. I thought, there's no way I'm going to keep that straight. I'm not going to bother. I've got to worry about this event. I'm not going to count basketball. So on two different levels, I was able to see the gorilla, not because I'm smarter, and I have failed many, many attention blindness tests, so I know I'm not good at this. But in that incident, I did because I wasn't focusing. Wow. And when you don't focus, you see something different than when you do. And just as Josh said, if people – where the trick really works for a magician is when people are paying attention. And then you can fool them, partly because their attention makes them blind to everything else.
Does it matter, Josh, if they're – because I do think that you get skilled at noticing that moment, that lapse – one-on-one, but then when you're working with a larger audience, you say, well, this is the moment. Right. Is it different working with a crowd since they all can't be in the same place at the same time?
It is. It's definitely different, and you just have to kind of – and you will not get – I mean, 50%, I think from my understanding, is about 50% of the people don't see the gorilla and 50% do. So in magic, you can't settle for 50 people catching your sneaky moves. So you got to, you know, do, yes, it's definitely different. And I can't even necessarily articulate how, but certainly there's a different flow and more of a planned out, like more of a thoughtfulness ahead of time. Like, this is the situation I need to create. Whereas when I do the close-up magic, I'm just kind of getting an intuitive sense based on the, you know, how long I've been performing and really trying to stay present in the moment and mindful. That's the other half of the attention thing. And part of it is the skill of a magician that I would have of trying to distract other people's attention. And then part of it is I become more attentive the more I do it. And I think that's really helpful. I really become more connected. And it's not just for the sense of fooling. It's because that's my own personal philosophy about entertaining people, is to connect with them. But it certainly helps me get into a rhythm with them and know the flow and get the right intuitive time to do a move or get away with something.
Attentive to them or attentive to the trick?
Attentive to them.
Yeah.
Attentive to them.
Wow.
I don't do the gorilla experiment anymore in my classes because too many people have seen it. But back before then, I could get about 90% of them to be blind simply by raising the ante. I would say things like, now make sure you don't get this wrong because this is an IQ test.
Mm.
And this is one of the best ways we have of saying what your real IQ is. And especially my brilliant Deustons would be so nervous.
You
they
do.
Wouldn't see the gorilla at all.
Right. Well, how much of the crowd do you think that matters? In other words, is there a kind of mass psychosis or anti-psychosis? I will not be psychotic.
Well, the one crowd experiment where, in general, the gorilla experiment got a 90% negative response, was college students in London seeing a live version of it with basketball players, but they'd all had a little to drink and they were all from the same kind of same college, and so there seemingly was some kind of peer pressure involved too, but people were shocked and it was also set up to make them compete a little bit to see who could get the most basketballs is how it was framed. So that competition made it, and I bet there's some part of that in magic too. I don't know.
There's also, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I'm not sure if you're familiar, there's a follow-up that I just fell for today on the internet for the people who are familiar with the gorilla experiment, where and they get 90% of the people to fall for it because you're arrogant. I think, well, I know the gorilla experiment, so I'm going to catch the gorilla, which I did. But then afterwards it said, did you notice that the entire curtain behind the people changed and two of the basketball players left? And I totally missed that because not only did I think I was counting basketballs, but I thought I knew the trick. I thought I knew what it was I was supposed to look for, and I thought I caught him because I saw the gorilla. And then I totally missed the purpose of the second experiment.
That's cool.
Jeff, what do you make of this idea that Josh just surprised me a second ago because he talked about being in the moment and attentive. And I'm thinking, well, you've got your hands. You got to get the card out of your pocket and you got to put the joker under the all that. That's what I need to be.
Now everyone's going to know I put the joker under.
I meant King of Diamonds. I'm sorry. What he said was, no, I'm attentive to the crowd. So I've actually put my attention there, and it sounds like deeply mindful attention. Mm-hmm. And yet his hands have to be doing something, and they have to do it right and pretty fast, right?
Right. Well, you know, again, I think our human potential is enormous. And, so if we can train ourselves on that spectrum of a selective narrow focus, you know, like one card, for instance, or one basketball pass, well, we can train ourselves to be present in the context. Another phrase associated with mindfulness that I like is clear comprehension, which really refers to seeing clearly what's happening in this moment. And that could be, you know, the one thing you're noticing, the sensation of this breath, but it could also be the open focus on all that's happening and really being available to notice what's coming in a way of, they say that, again, the brainwave patterns synchronize in a way that the input is kind of optimized.
On the State of Things today, talking about attention, Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke Integrative Medicine. Kathy Davidson's a professor of interdisciplinary studies in English at Duke. She's got a book called Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. And Joshua Lozov is a magician, and our conversation on the State of Things continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about attention. Kathy Davidson, professor of interdisciplinary studies in English at Duke. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke Integrative Medicine. And magician Joshua Lozov. Let's go back to you, Josh. The idea that anybody goes to see a magician, we know it's a trick, right? We know it really isn't magic, and yet we're dazzled and we're awestruck by this. Have you given that thought? Why do people go see a magician?
I've given it a lot of thought. And in some ways, I feel like it's similar to other art forms where we know that Meryl Streep isn't really losing her child, but it doesn't prevent us from getting I think there may be a difference between an emotional reality and an intellectual reality. So I feel like people my goal is for people to have this emotional experience of something impossible without any intention on my part that they walk out believing that I have supernatural ability. But I don't think that means that I still do try to create the moment where something impossible has happened. I don't wink at them and say, of course, this is all just a gag. When I'm doing it, I'm really committed, because the difference between Meryl Streep and your kid at a school play is that you never get drawn into that emotional experience with your kid because they're winking at the audience and they're forgetting their lines. So to create that moment, you have to commit to it being real as much as Meryl Streep does. But that's still separate from trying to scam anyone into thinking that your powers are real. You know?
But it does strike me as slightly different, Kathy, and I want to get your take on this. If I go to a movie, I always know that there was a script and there was makeup and that's how that movie was made. But when I leave the magic act, I was fooled. And why do I not walk away humiliated? Why am I not humiliated? Why am I uplifted? And I want to see that again. I love that experience.
It's a great thought. And I'm a total aficionado of magic. I love it. I love reading about it. I love reading books about magicians, both the skill of the magician to do that. I mean, I think there's something about that, because a magician isn't hurting you. And you know that it isn't happening by accident. It's happening because somebody spent a lot of time practicing and learning a kind of attention. I also think we all like it when someone pays attention to us. And you know that the magician couldn't have made that happen without really being aware of how we operate, how we tick, right? What's more flattering than somebody knowing how we tick, even if they're making making us believe them, you know, right, doing a trick, tricking us. Where I get nervous, and I at one point interviewed people who made direct-to-consumer drug ads, is there's a purpose that is not necessarily a good purpose, where we all know the FDA regulates on consumer TV ads, and the U.S. and New Zealand are the only two countries in the world that allow you to have prescription ads advertised on TV. And the FDA carefully regulates what you're allowed to say, and you have to say all the side effects. So actors actually go to school to learn how to say the side effects in a way that conforms to the speed and the volume required by the FDA, but in such a lulling way that it sounds almost like a lullaby, and you don't really pay attention to the liver damage and the fatalities and the suicide caused by some prescription drug or another. So it's using those attentional devices, but not necessarily in a way that edifies you, but in a way that tricks you. And I think that's the difference, is intention, is the mystery and the awe versus maybe making you do something that you should be paying more attention to.
Jeff Brantley, what about that, the notion of attention or intention in all of this, and the difference between walking away feeling humiliated and otherwise walking away in a sense of wonder and awe?
Well, you know, we were talking about attention as a way of opening the channels for information to flow into our working memory. We put it selectively, or we open it, or whatever. And we have an intention about, well, what is it we're looking for? We're going to intend to know more about drug sales, or we're going to know more about magic, or whatever it is, or, you know, finding peace and stress reduction through meditation. We have an intention that helps us coordinate, I think, our activities and our actions, and that impacts somehow how the information flows into what's called our working memory. I think what happens in the sense of being uplifted, what's the interpretation, the story we tell ourselves about what just happened? You come out of that, or me too, or any with the magic, you know, it's like what I'm uplifted is I'm reminded that what my little ego mind thinks it knows is incomplete. And there's a sense of wonder and awe about being reminded of that. Who hasn't looked at the sky and wondered about the stars, you know? So that sense of being reminded that there's more to us humans than just our little ego story about things. And I think the humiliation piece is when our little ego story decides that somehow we've been conned and starts to feel bad about that. So it's the interpretation we put on the information stream. But the attention is really just about opening up the channels for the information to come in to the working memory, so that all the other cognitive and emotional parts of our nervous system and brain can do their thing around the perception and the narrative.
Well, around that story then, and around that idea, How important is the way we structure knowledge? I mean, you talk about Duke students. So there's a way of learning, right? We're taught to pay attention in school to certain things because of the way we're rewarded. It doesn't, and it's cultural, right? It changes from place to place. So to what extent is that kind of training, that meta-training in what to pay attention to structurally, that transfers from work to school, how does that shape the way we pay attention?
Wow. Well, I actually try to subvert that, and I'm teaching a class now with behavioral economist Dan Ariely called Surprise Endings, and part of the surprise is our students run the class. So we don't. They interview us. They do some readings. They propose. There's a teams of four propose readings. They blog about it for the public online before the class. We just filmed our Valentine's Day special about love and romance, and but the students surprise us by coming up with a narrative and asking us questions, and then they edit the film and put it online, and then they do some kind of a trick, including sometimes magic tricks, to convince us and to try to make us think about topics like self-control, which we're not so good at as humans. But I think the point of that, turning the classroom around, is to get us away from thinking attention is always something hierarchical that someone makes you do and make you a little bit more mindful of your own learning. And turning, once you know something and have to teach it to somebody else or have to translate it, it's a different level of knowing than when you just regurgitate it on a test or, you know, ace your GREs or your SATs.
Is it difficult for them to reverse roles like that and to get
it
out of
is.
That mold?
Actually, we sent two or three emails before the class saying, read carefully what you have to do in this class because it's not like anything else. And I would say about a third of the class turned over and dropped the class.
Nice.
And then another third. Then we had a long waiting list of people who were in. So the people who are in there really want to be there and feel like it's something very, very special that for finally they're in a situation where they get to drive their own learning.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
it is
amazing.
About attention.
You get to a place like Duke, you had to do pretty well in a particular kind of learning. And yet, if I flip the paradigm, if I change the way we do things, I'm out of water here. I can't swim.
Right. And the real world is much more about the second.
Yeah.
The real world is much, much more about having to take the whole crazy world of information that's out there and synthesize it in some way that makes our lives meaningful, whether it's in the workplace or in everyday life.
Josh, I'd give you a chance to respond to any of that, but I do have a question as well, and that is, Does magic change from country to country culturally? Does it work differently? Are there tricks that work some places and don't work other places?
Yeah, absolutely. I've found that to be the case because I've done quite a bit of traveling. And a lot of what I do at this point in my general show is more what's called mentalism themed. And again, it's not claiming psychic power, but it is really about psychology. And there's magic principles involved too, but about subliminal things and trying to get people. It's more psychological based than sleight of hand based. And when I brought that to Japan, they didn't dig it, really, in general. I mean, there might have been individuals, of course, but in general, they are going to a magic show to appreciate skill. So something that looks like it doesn't involve any skill, like me knowing what card somebody's thinking of in their mind or, you know, predicting a number that someone else is going to do later, isn't as much fun as something that looks like it requires a lot of dexterity. So for what it's worth, I have found that to be the case, that some things change from place to place.
And I wonder, Jeff, if you would restructure, I mean, mindfulness, this particular practice that you teach is one that's developed here. It really is for people of a Western culture in the United States. Does it even make sense to teach this in other places where it'd be almost foolish to even try this? And
well, you know, mindfulness, you like to say, and I'm inspired by not only Buddhist teachers, but my mentor, one of them, John Kabat-Zinn, who made mindfulness training relevant to health-focused and stress reduction programs. Mindfulness is a human capacity. Every human being has had the experience of noticing, feeling the wind against their face, or noticing, you know, that their mind is obsessing over something, or feeling the warmth of the sun. So this quality of knowing that's not thinking, that actually can notice what the thinking is what we call mindfulness or awareness. It's in the present moment. It's likened to a good mirror. It just reflects what's here. It's kind of like a talent, though, or it's a natural talent we have. But to make it really sharp and penetrating into the different contexts and situations, then we get to the skills. And we've been talking about particularly the skill of attention. But there's also the skill of intention, intending to be mindful, knowing why and what it is, why you do it. The other skill is the skill of the open-hearted, non-judging quality, the welcoming attitude to whatever it is we're observing mindfully. And we can cultivate each of these, intention, attention, and attitude, and they help sort of nourish and strengthen our natural capacity to be present with awareness.
Do you find, though, when you're teaching, you're, on the one hand, cultivating a practice, a sort of a natural quality, a natural resource that we're born with. On the other hand, how much unlearning do we have to do because of the way we've been taught to learn and focus?
Well, as you, I know you know, Frank, because you and I have talked about this, but many others know too. We have to unlearn. It's more a matter, I think, of recognizing our habits of inattention and distractedness, including our habits of negative self-talk and perceptual distortion, and noticing and letting them go. In the mindfulness training, the non-judging includes that we don't have to fix it. It's good enough to just notice if our mind wandered and then gently, kindly bring it back. So the unlearning, in a way, includes the unlearning of self-criticism and self-doubt, learning to recognize these energies in us, these habits, and not be so over-identified with them.
Would we be better off, Kathy, to start working on some of these practices or at least think about a different way to structure learning and attention so that we'd have sort of more supple and nimble students able to with a broader capacity for change?
I think so. And learning how to collaborate with people who are very different from yourself. And especially in the global world we live in now, more and more of us are coming in contact with people who don't necessarily share our beliefs, our cultural practices, our behaviors. And it's very easy to think, well, the way I'm doing things is the only right way. And learning a kind of mindfulness where you're receptive to very different ways of framing the world, I think is a survival skill in the 21st century. I mean, to me, that's the most important thing we can do, is not only be mindful about ourselves, but mindful about others too. And the way that if we have a certain kind of openness, we can be complementary in a way that's very, very productive.
Josh, it sounds like a great starting point is just get everybody in a room and realize no matter how smart you were, I can fool you.
Great way to start. That's where I come in.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for being on the program. Great to talk with each of you today. Joshua Lozoff is a magician. Jeffrey Brantley is director of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke Integrative Medicine. And Kathy Davidson is a professor of Interdisciplinary Studies and English at Duke University. And has a book called Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. Thank you so much for being on the program.
A pleasure.
Thank you. That was so fun.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.